Today is Friday, December 6th, 2019. This is a Part 6 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with John Weisheit, W-E-I-S-H-E-I-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, John. How are you today?
I'm very well, Tom. Thank you.
Good. Glad to hear it. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We wrapped up part five. You had introduced us to the formation of the group Glen Canyon Action Network, which soon transitioned into an organization called Living Rivers.
Yes.
And this part of Living Rivers, you did some interesting campaigns. Can you talk about some of those campaigns?
Yes. Well, I guess we're...
Ah, no worries.
We talked about, well, you know, so we want to do different stuff. You know, we want to return to grassroots organizing, and so we did road shows. You know, it would take anywhere from 6 to 9 months to prepare for this stuff. You know, the first one was a tour in a water truck.
Okay.
So we went to a construction rental facility in Grand Junction and rented a 5,000 gallon water tank, and we did a road show called the Sustainable Water Project, and we went to the 7 states and collected water from irrigation districts and fountains and reservoirs, and you know, and we would put it inside the water tank. And eventually, what we did was we went to the Colorado River limitrophe and put that water in the Colorado River to demonstrate and support the restoration of the Colorado River Delta.
How did you get the water from fountains and those sorts of places? Like buckets? Did you bucket it out there? How'd that work?
Yeah, so like we went to the old plaza in Los Angeles and had a, you know, which was when the Spaniards were occupying, when the Spaniards were occupying the coastal plain of California. You know, they were using local, you know, the Los Angeles River, and there's an old plaza there with a fountain, and we just took a 5 gallon bucket of water. You know, it was done very ceremoniously. We had tribal people with us too. And we would gather the water in a 5 gallon bucket. It was an orange pail, and we would climb up the ladder of the water truck and open up the lid and throw it in.
Okay.
And so, you know, so obviously we had rallies, we had, the press was invited. We even, when we went to Hoover Dam, for example, we got permission from the Bureau of Reclamation to access Lake Mead through, on the Nevada side, through the ladders and stuff that they have there next to the spillway.
Okay.
And allowed us to actually dip our bucket into Lake Mead.
Wow.
So, when we went to Imperial Valley, we would see an open ditch and we would fill it up. And so we did this, you know, in every state. I don't think we went to Wyoming, though.
So there's a 5,000 gallon tank and a 5 gallon bucket, maybe a little less than that. So that's over 1,000 trips up and down with the little bucket.
We didn't fill the tank.
Okay.
It was, you know, we did a prank. We did a... It wasn't a prank. It was very ceremoniously. It was done very respectfully.
Right. And the concept here was to help people sort of get an education about where Colorado River water has gone.
Right.
Being drawn out of the river. In so many different locations.
Yes.
Nice. Yes. How many miles did you put on the truck?
Oh, not as much as you might think. More than 3,000, less than 5,000,
Okay,
somewhere.
that's a good distance in a water truck.
Yeah. I was the driver.
Okay, that must have been kind of terrifying at times.
You just, think slow.
Yeah.
React slow. Just take your time.
Nice.
Oh, and we had it, the tank had a big banner on it, like a 15-foot banner. We had another truck that carried instruments and sleeping bags and camp gear. We camped out a lot,
Okay.
and very rarely did we stay in a, obviously we're not going to park a water tank in a residential area or a,
Right.
so we camped out.
Okay. And
And then,
where did you let the water go?
well, we ended our tour. I think it was, it was in California when we decided to go home, and we intentionally went to Yuma. You have to think about a dual axle water truck. Where you can actually go. Our goal was to go at least below Morales Dam, and when we were doing this, it was like 9 p.m. or 10 p.m., still
Okay.
dark, and there were border patrol people everywhere,
Okay.
but not one of them. They all knew. They must have known we were coming.
Okay.
They ignored us.
Okay.
And then we attached the hose to the tank, and then we dragged the hose into the Colorado River, and we let her rip.
Great.
There's actually no river there. There's some seepage. And of course, it went into the ground
Right.
immediately. Of course, it didn't go all the way to the Delta, but
Right.
we did restore it to where we w where it should, where it really belongs.
What did you specifically learn from that journey?
Number one, we still do have our constitutional rights to express ourselves. You have to get permits. We're very transparent about our where we were going and who we were going to see. We did press releases every day. We called. We had cell phones. We called the press. Hey, we're here. We got a lot of response from the press. It's well recorded in the public record. We got front page stuff. One in particular was a picture of the water tank going across the top of Hoover Dam.
Nice.
Las Vegas Review Journal front page. And it was we called all our activist friends and organizations, and they all showed up. We had tribal singers and musicians. It was a really good event. Well organized, no flaws, no catastrophes. Everything went really, really well.
Nice.
And we did a
Did
like a
sorry, I'm going to jump in here. Did David Brower attend any of these? Did he come along?
No, he
Okay.
died November 2000,
Ah,
and
okay.
this was in 2001.
Okay.
We had a lot of John Muir Sierrans on the trip.
Okay.
John Muir Sierrans were a faction of the Sierra Club. There were a few of them on the board,
Okay.
Sierra Club board. David Brower, Dave Foreman. And let's see. And there were some others. Gordon LeBay and the Bologna Wetlands Marcia Hanscom.
You mentioned Brent Blackweller when we were...
Yeah, that was the next event, which
okay.
was called The Sentimental Journey. Not sentimental, sedimental. It was about...
S-E-D-I-M-E-N-T?
Yes.
Sedimental journey.
Yeah, and this time it wasn't a water truck, it was a dump truck full of sand.
Did you go back to the same rental company and say, we need a dump truck? Did you?
We never told them what it was for.
Okay.
We just said we need it for 10 days, and they said, okay,
uh-huh.
I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had a dual axle dump truck, and our opening event was below Moab at Gold Bar, and we went out in inflatable kayaks and with 5-gallon buckets, and there was an island, a sand island out there, and we were using the sand beach materials to fill our buckets, which we then put into sandbags because, you know, if we just put it in the back of the truck, it would just blow all over the place.
Huh.
So we put them in, bags that, you know, that people use for like temporary flood control.
Okay.
Sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we had a big party. And we had musicians. And that's inaugurated our sentimental journey. And we did the same thing.
So again, the concept was?
That, you know, this was some of the stuff that Brower and Ingram brought up in their testimony for the Colorado River Storage Project Act of 1968, and also the Colorado River Storage Project Act of 1956 and the Colorado River Basin Project Act of 1968, and which was, you know, sediment is going to eventually compromise flood control and water storage, and you know, you're just, you might be saving Lake Mead, but now Lake Powell's going to fill up with sediment.
Mm.
To demonstrate that they really haven't, they being the states and the feds, haven't really, they don't have a sustainable plan. You know, they have these dams have lifespans.
Right.
They don't last forever. And therefore, these water projects don't last forever. And now, you know, at one point there was only 5 million people in the basin, and now there's 40. And pretty soon they're saying there's going to be 60. So, but they're all dependent on an infrastructure that has a finite lifespan. And sediment is the first thing that's going to take that away.
Okay.
Because reservoirs fill up with sediment. When they become 50% full, they're no longer able to provide flood control, which is actually the primary reason why these reservoirs were built. And you don't have room for water storage to regulate, to regulate water for year-round purposes, especially for farmers that have 12 months of growing season. So, you know, so in other words, sediment is the number one enemy of the Colorado River Compact and its need and purpose statement. You know, so what are you guys going to do about it?
Right.
That
so
worked because the press asked, you know, yeah, this is a legitimate question. What Mr. Bureau Reclamation Commissioner, what are you going to do about this? And they said, basically, you know, kick the can down the road. We don't have to worry about that now. That's a problem for later.
Right. So the idea was to slowly fill the truck up with sediment and take it down to Yuma and then hit the dump button? How is that going to work?
Well, yeah. So, we didn't go to the Colorado River Delta to dump our sediment load. We went to the Little Colorado River.
Ah.
Because, as you know, Glen Canyon Dam stores the sediment below, releases clear, cold water, and consequently all the sediment in the Grand Canyon is creeping into the river and flowing down into Lake Mead, and there's no sediment there for vegetation. Archaeology sites are being exposed. River runners don't have places to camp, you know, so we wanted to go to Lee's Ferry.
Hmm.
And the Park Service said, absolutely not. You need a 404 permit to do that.
Okay. The concept is we're gonna take a bunch of sediment from the river above Lake Powell.
Yep.
And we're gonna go around to the other side of Glen Canyon Dam and put the sediment back in the river.
Yes.
Pretty simple concept. But at Lee's Ferry, which is below Glen Canyon Dam, or downstream of Glen Canyon Dam, managed by the National Park Service, they wouldn't let you put the sediment in the river.
No, they would not.
Now, there are rules about sediment going into clear rivers. Army Corps of Engineers has that sediment rule, is that right?
Yes, it does. Okay. For a permit.
Okay. And that's what the Park Service was citing?
Yeah. You can't do this.
Okay.
You can't, even though we were restoring a natural process.
Right.
You know, they just didn't want us there.
Okay.
They didn't, you know, it was too embarrassing for them. So we came up with an alternative plan. We on the way home, you know, we got to Cameron, and you know how there's the truck bypass road, which
yep.
no longer is used. Yeah, you know, we used that road, and to get to the Little Colorado River, and that's where we put it.
All right, and so then that sediment would have washed back into the Grand Canyon, back into the Colorado River below Glen Canyon Dam. Okay. Excellent. And how was that received by the press and Bureau of Reclamation and?
Well, we got, you know, it worked very well, like the water truck. We got a lot of press. We went through the seven states, except Wyoming, and lots of press. And lots of events, and we did, you know, I should also add that we did educational venues, you know, here's what's happening in Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And to create awareness. You know.
Great.
You know, and what also was happening was the 100th anniversary of the Reclamation Act of 1902.
Ah.
So we did a big rally at Hoover Dam in the visitors' parking lot on the Arizona side.
Okay.
Very close to the dam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting permits for this wasn't time-consuming or hard, you know. You just involved a lot of telephone calls, a lot of writing. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're not going to do. You know, phone calls with security,
uh-huh.
law enforcement of the dam, which is Bureau of Reclamation law enforcement officers, just letting them know and they what we're going to do. And they were very cooperative, very
uh-huh.
helpful. Yeah,
okay.
They made sure that we passed through the dam safely without interrupting traffic. They escorted us through. You know, they allowed the press to, like, stand at high places that normally visitors aren't allowed to go to so that they can get their optimal picture. You
nice.
Know, they were very cooperative, very helpful.
And this was before September 11.
No, it was was after September 11th.
After September 11th, okay.
Yeah, this event was after September 11th. The first event was after, no, I think, yeah, it was before 9/11. The water truck event was before 9/11, and the dump truck event was after 9/11.
Okay. But you still had a lot of help and assistance. That's great. So these two tours, sort of the no water tour and the no sediment tour, then what happened?
Well, we did another one. And you were involved in that one. So was Kim Crumbo. And that was about the Colorado River Management Plan and operations for recreational opportunities management in Grand Canyon National Park. We wanted to emphasize that the Grand Canyon should become a wilderness and that it should be a non-motorized river corridor. And we did an event. I think that happened during, actually that did happen during the sedimental journey.
That's right.
We brought the dump truck to Lee's Ferry.
Right.
We had, they cordoned off of First Amendment site at the parking overflow parking lot. We camped out at Lee's Ferry Campground on the high bench, and we had microphones, and people were rigging trips, and we did an event there. We had music, some speakers. it was kind of a nice, warm, sunny day.
Yes.
And Brent Blackwelder was there. And we did a float trip. We actually hired, we brought our paddle boats, and we used the outfitter that services the section above Lee's Ferry for tourists.
Right.
And they did a tour, downstream tour from the dam, unloaded their clients, and then we loaded our paddle boats onto their boats, and they drove us up to the top of the river below the power dam release area. And we blew up our boats and did a float trip. And Brett Blackwelder was there, president of Friends of the Earth. Was Jeff there? Jeff Ingram came too, didn't he? Oh, no, that was an event. Then we did an event at the north rim of the Grand Canyon. And Jeff was there, and David Haskell.
Okay.
And we got permission to use the outside court to stage our event. We had Havasupai people there and Wallapai people there, and we had speakers. Jeff Ingram gave a speech. David Haskell gave a speech. It wasn't well attended, but all the National Park Service people were there.
Okay.
And you were there, or were you?
Not on the north rim.
Crumbo was there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Because he lived there. Yeah, I think Crumbo was there. He was definitely at Lee's Ferry.
Right. Right. And so the concepts are the dams and the water management has altered the river, not only for its waters, which do not make it to the Sea of Cortez, but for the flotsam, the biotic community destruction, once the sediment and driftwood and all the biotic material has been stripped out of the water, which is what dams do.
Right.
Also impacts recreation, certainly. But I guess the Bureau of Reclamation would say, yeah, but this is all we're serving 40, 45 million people. Living in the Southwest off this water structure is way more important than delivering water to the Sea of Cortez or having a healthy rivers with sediment and biotic material, and that having river runners camp on sandbars. I certainly get that last part there. So, you know, what were you guys thinking about this?
Well, that's why we did it. We want to show that that this all comes to an end someday, and that in the meantime we are, you know, our biodiversity is in decline.
Right.
The values for which we created the National Park Service through the Organic Act is compromised. We unfortunately destroyed very beautiful places, very sacred places that should have been in the Park Service, not in the domain of the Bureau of Reclamation to build concrete dams.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since we know they don't last forever.
Right.
National parks last forever.
Right.
At least they're supposed to.
Right.
You know, so are we going to, are we going to preserve public lands or are we going to, you know, are our public lands, we understand multiple use, but we think you went too far. In fact, we know you went too far. So it's about creating an atmosphere of, like, scaling down demands, not building redundant infrastructure that has diminishing returns. It means not interrupting the natural flow of nature. Colorado River has been going to the Pacific Ocean for 6 million years, and it never hurt anybody until we showed up. And so, 20th century, 19th century ideas weren't properly vetted. We definitely didn't listen to the tribes.
Right.
No, we didn't ask them about their sacred sites, their burials. We just did it, you know, manifest destiny. We planted our flag and we just took over. So we're doing everything we're like, oh. So now, you know, there's a new consciousness, like, oh, we shouldn't have done that. Well, then they say, well, we did, so we'll just use it while we can, but it doesn't last forever. Well, yeah, again, like I said, we'll just use it while we can.
Right.
I go, but what are you going to do? How are you going to decommission this? How are you going to get rid of the sediment? What happens if a big flood comes and takes everything out?
Right.
You know, and the answer is, well, we're going to kick the can down the road and talk about that later. We have shortages to worry about, and we have surpluses to worry about, and we have 7 states and Mexico and tribes. We have all these problems that are more urgent than long-term stability. And so it's business as usual. It's not best management practices for sure.
So those sound like some pretty energetic, really brilliant campaigns to simply help the population of the Southwest understand the technological ramifications of their very existence. And this is now approaching 20 years ago.
It is.
And the same issues continue. But let's not jump ahead too fast. What did these campaigns morph into, or did you continue with you mentioned then the Colorado River Management Plan for Grand Canyon National Park, and that journey, and then after that, did you do more campaigns like this?
No, we so we left our ice cream location in Moab in 2005, and Owen got married to a Thai Chinese woman and moved to Southeast Asia to work on river and dam issues in Southeast Asia. And the economy, of course, crashed, and the Energy Policy Act of 2005 was initiated. This is the policy that created that what we now call fracking for oil and gas.
Okay.
It also included strip mining tar sands and kerogen deposits known as hard rock oil shale. And so that kind of distracted us for a while because we it was looking a lot at where I live in eastern Utah, because the oil shale non-conventional oil and gas development and tar sands were all in eastern Utah and western Colorado.
Okay.
And it potentially, of course, was going to become a greenhouse emissions bomb,
Right.
a carbon bomb, and it was also going to take at least 500,000 acre feet of water that the Colorado River doesn't have. So we put a lot of time and energy into the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And so that we had lawsuits. I mean, boy, did we have lawsuits. I think I must be signed on to 80 of them.
Okay.
So it's about groundwater pollution, industrial accidents that have gone down the river, and
Right, so it's surface water pollution as well.
yes, groundwater pollution. Fortunately, the only thing that has happened is oil and gas development. And the tar sands and oil shale is just not happening. And I think it's very clear that's because we don't have the water. And but you have all these young startup investors that want to play with it, get investors to think about it, and but a lot of proposals, but nothing's ever really developed. And so it was for the last 10 years, it's been a very much a dead dog. And the oil and gas, the gas will probably be producing gas for another 50 years, but the oil, it's very deep oil. It's paraffinic oil. It in the Earth's crust, it's liquid, but when you bring it to the surface, it turns to candle wax,
Okay.
essentially. And so when they, that's going to be gone in 10 years. And they do a lot of flaring. There's a lot of methane emissions. It's just, and boy, has it scarred the landscape.
Right.
It's a disaster area. tens of thousands of well pads.
Yeah, the images from Google Earth are stunning. It looks like a bad case of acne.
It's really bad. And for what? So yeah, so it was a Keep It In The Ground campaign, and it was done through a lot of coalitions. So some of the organizations that actually do stuff, file lawsuits, run campaigns. Center for Biological Diversity, Wild Earth Guardians, a lot of conservation diversity, or biological diversity groups, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sage grouse habitat, endangered fish of the Colorado River, yeah. It's a lot of time and effort into this campaign. But maybe in 2014, Owen comes, he comes every year to visit. And he said, John, let's get in the car, and just you and I, and let's just do a road tour and talk to people.
Okay.
And we've been doing that for the last 5 years. So we have a Toyota Highlander. It's a hatchback, and we put our camping gear. We camped out as much as possible.
Okay.
And we would make phone calls and saying, hey, we're in your area. Can we talk to you? And nobody said no. Everybody wanted to talk to us.
And who did you visit with?
We visited allies. We visited top water managers. We visited scientists, mostly scientists. We spent a lot of time in scientists that work on climate change issues and hydrology and atmospheric sciences. And wherever we went, we would ask questions like, so are we in trouble? And the answers were, oh yeah, we're in trouble. And so what should we do? And I says, they would all say, we need to do something different. Nobody said, oh no, everything's fine. We just, nobody said that. We began to realize that everybody knows this all comes to an end. Even the water managers. And I won't name names because I don't think.
Right.
But you'll just have to trust me when I say top dog water managers.
Well, they must be looking at demand outstripping supply, even in the best of scenarios. That would happen year after year, decade after decade. And if any of that were to fail, like supply decreased a little more as demand continues to increase, that's a recipe for failure. Not to mention global warming, species collapse, etc.
Yeah, it became very apparent to us that the scientists were going to be the most helpful.
Okay.
We would ask them questions like, what do you think of 2000 interim guidelines? And it's, Band-Aid, too little. What do you think of the 2012 basin study? Oh, absolutely terrible. It wasn't even an EIS. The peer review was terrible.
Hmm.
We don't like it. It's not a useful document.
Okay.
We were surprised that people actually read this stuff. Because we certainly did. we asked the right questions because we've read the documents. Also, we're on record. All our comments are on the internet. You can find them in less than a minute.
Right.
And so we went out there knowing the science, knowing the policy, knowing the law. We knew the right questions. And we found out that everybody else has that same level of knowledge and experience. And they all have the same opinion. that this is a system that's going to fail. And then the next question is will you help? And they all said yes.
Okay.
Except for federal scientists. Federal scientists are kind of like in a, you know, their style is cramped a little bit.
Right.
So, most helpful people were Harold Tyus, who's an ethnologist from the University of Colorado at Boulder.
How do you spell Harold's last name?
T-Y-U-S.
Thank you.
He worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service in the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
With William L. Minkley.
Okay.
And so he's a diehard conservation biologist who said, yeah, we're not, you know, so the question to Harold is, so are we conserving fish? And he said, absolutely not.
Okay.
You know, tell us more. And the other helpful person was Vic Baker.
Okay.
And so we talked to some of the, we talked to a lot of scientists, Tom, maybe 80 of them.
And I'm assuming that this road tour, the annual road tour, must take you to all seven states, if not more.
Yes, we spent a lot of time in Wyoming this time.
Okay. What did you learn at Wyoming that you hadn't touched on before?
Well, you know, so Wyoming is a very high country, high elevation country. Not much of a growing season. There's no tribes in Wyoming in the Colorado River Basin. There are in the Missouri River Basin and the Snake River Basin, there are tribes. But
huh.
There's no tribes in the Colorado River Basin in Wyoming. You know. So it's called the Great Sage Ocean, you know, water coming out of the Wind Range.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. You know, Owen and I went to Flaming Gorge and Fontanelle is like, why is this even here? And it's basically to just keep the fishery alive while they divert water. You know, it doesn't really have any other use than that. But it's got non-native fish in it. I mean, really, what are you conserving? Are you conserving wild fish or non-native? The answer is both. You know, and it's important to understand that's the section. The section actually below Flaming Gorge is why we have the Endangered Species Act. And that is the incident that happened in 1962.
Right. The fish kill.
Yes. And that was instigated by the state fisheries and the federal fisheries departments agreed, and obviously they didn't consult with their boss, Stuart Udall. So they start this retinone poisoning to kill all the native fish so they can put in rainbow trout, brown trout. And this is the connection with Harold Tyus and Minkley, because you know, the person they stood on the shoulders of Robert Miller. This is the guy, he's from the University of, it's either Minnesota or Michigan. And he, every summer, would come to the Colorado River Basin with students, and they would, you know, they found the humpback chub in, like, 1947. They didn't even know it existed until Robert Miller started poking around.
Huh.
So, you know, so this is post-World War II, you know. So these the colleges start showing up. And Robert Miller knew they were, he was in the field, he noticed they were poisoning the river, and he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, which was read by Wallace Stegner, who's had monthly meetings with Stuart Udall, National Parks Committee. And when Stuart Udall's reaction was to call up his employees in Wyoming and Colorado and Utah to cease and desist. Stop this retinoid poisoning. And then the 1964 Wilderness Act was passed, and they used that conservation of biology discussed in the Wilderness Act to create the first endangered species list in 1967. And then, of course, we got the Endangered Species Act in 1973. In that 1967 list is the Colorado River pike minnow and the humpback chub. That was a national list. But the thing that promulgated it was the rotenone poisoning below Flaming Gorge Dam on the Green River. That's
right.
Where we got the Endangered Species Act.
Okay. So it's a fascinating journey of building dams, trying to control water and water delivery. And then, if the dams weren't bad enough, trying to support exotic fisheries in the clear water releases below the dams, whether it was Flaming Gorge or Glen Canyon, which has the same issue of the state trying to maintain a trophy trout fishery for 12 miles, and then the water crosses a line and goes into a national park, Grand Canyon National Park, in which case the exotic fish being stocked upstream are not desirable, and the native fish are. So it's a complete flip of focus.
Yes.
So the poison dumped in the river upstream to make the trophy trout fishing, of course, goes down into the national park lands below, you suddenly have the feds against the states, and the feds against the feds, which has a long history of reclamation against National Park Service and vice versa. And the resources caught in the middle in a terrible vice.
Yes.
So as you did this road tour, these scientists were well aware of this.
But scientists are busy, you know, they got papers to write and students to teach and funding to, you know, to acquire. And so, you know, we asked them, like, well, how about we write a letter? We'll write the first draft and let you take a look at the final draft and edit it. And they said, yeah, okay, we'll do that.
Okay.
So we had a statement. And we decided... we're working together, you know, Owen and I had the idea, yes, but, you know, we worked on this together with all the scientists, and we thought, you know, that this should be a letter addressed to Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell, and it should be about why the basin study is not the document to carry us through the 21st century, and we thought... The ask was, could the Academy, the National Academy of Sciences, review the basin study? That was the ask. And so we got 23 scientists to sign on to this letter, and we sent it to Vic Baker, wrote the cover letter on University of Arizona letterhead.
Okay.
And we did email. email exchanges with the 23 to let them know what we were up to, and nobody said don't do it, so we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some press, and we got some bites, and we didn't get a response from Sally until, that was in October of 2015, and in February of 2016, they finally addressed it. And then the person who signed the response letter was some secretary or something. It didn't really have Sally's name on it or Estevan, the commissioner of Bureau of Reclamation's name on it, but it, the letter did make it clear that this was an official statement from the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of Interior that says thank you very much for your letter, but we're not going to do this.
Okay.
The basin study is fine. It's a great document. So while we were doing our roadshow, we were in Orange County and were introduced to a grant officer for the National Science Foundation who has the right to approve discretionary funding under $50,000.
Okay.
You know, without going through committees. You know, they're allowed to wave their magic wand if it's less than $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked him if this was something he would find value in, and he said absolutely. And so then our next job is we need to find a university to get to accept this $50,000 grant and write the grant. So we, Owen and I, of course, by this time have talked to several scientists in all different states, and we decided that that maybe we should ask Kathy Jacobs to write the grant at the from the University of Arizona.
Okay.
And she said she would, and she did, and she got the money. And but $50,000 doesn't go very far.
Right.
So then Owen and I are talking to funders, and the funders that have been supporting us, funders that actually live in the Colorado River Basin, funders that actually understand what's going on along the Colorado River because they live near it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they all said, yeah, we'll support this. Yes, you bet. So we got it up to like $125,000, and then we eventually got it up to like $250,000. And so Kathy had enough money to get something going. And so in October of 2017, 33 scientists met for a 3-day conference. And with the question, like, what do we need to start doing in the Colorado River Basin in the future? And the answer from the 33 scientists was, you need to do some scenario planning for low probability, high consequence events. In other words, long and enduring drought and extreme flooding. Because all these things, the reason why is because the infrastructure cannot support this kind of climate regime.
Okay.
So we're talking about not the normal hydrologic spectrum, but the complete hydrological spectrum.
Right. I think of a bell-shaped curve, sort of the cross-section of what a church bell would look like.
Yes.
And the typical events happen on the sides and the top of the bell. Down on the far right and far left-hand sides are these low-probability, high-severity areas whether it's drought or flood, that will really make the bell ring.
Exactly. So, in other words, get out of your box. Start, you know, think outside of the box and develop, you know, so it's the scenario, you know, it's not to say that the Bureau has not done scenario planning. They have. It's just not, it's kind of like tucked away.
Mm-hmm.
It's not front and center, and it's not, you know, it's there if you, you know, if you get, like, you get a 1,600-page document, it's in there, but it's not clear, it's not concise, and it doesn't really, you know, have good, strong data or a good, strong narrative. You know, it just, it's a place mark. Yeah, we know this could happen, but we're not... But they don't spend a lot of time or effort. You know, it's over with in a paragraph. You know, it should be a chapter.
That's interesting. Saw the Grand Canyon National Park incident planning for a failure of Glen Canyon Dam. It was a few pages long.
Yes.
That's all. And say, oh, okay, all right. Well, you know, this is how high the water's going to go. All these people below this line need to get out. This is how we're going to do it with helicopters, and that's that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal for Grand Canyon. I mean, if Glen Canyon Dam goes, it just eviscerates 300 feet of the corridor, if not 400.
Right, right.
I mean, what kind of national park are you going to have?
Well, some people would argue a pretty dynamic one. Let's go visit.
Yeah, but look what's going to get flushed downstream. I mean, you know, snow melts rise slowly, go down slowly. They're very, very high.
Right.
Not 300 right. feet tall.
Well, this would be, as we talked about the other day, the buzz cut in the haircut analogy. This is not a trim. This is a Yul Brynner event.
Oh, God.
On the magnitude that the basin may have never seen before, though possibly once or twice in, you know, 9 million years is a long time, to have some sort of upper basin entrapment failure that sends a fairly large scouring flow down to the Sea of Cortez.
But with buildings?
Oh, yeah. Well, the material... the toxics involved would be phenomenal. So it's a journey in looking at these high severity, low probability events. And did the agency? Well, it sounds like the agency agreed to do that, but they just haven't done it in a robust kind of way.
Well, yeah, you know, so the first event was in October 2017, just 33 scientists. The next event was with stakeholders.
Okay.
And that's in 2018. It was in April. And I was invited to that particular event. And the Bureau of Reclamation gave Kathy some money and Denver Water gave Kathy some money, and eventually the Walton Foundation showed up and gave her some money. And but the Walton family, I mean, I want to make this clear, they came later, they weren't the first to show up.
Okay.
And
they seem to have a reputation for having an agenda which isn't necessarily fitting the journey of, can you speak to that a little bit? I mean, I don't want to sort of put words in your mouth.
Well, every founder has an agenda.
Okay.
Is dam removal one of those for the Walton Foundation? I would say no.
Okay.
They're pretty much... business as usual, status quo. We're here's a few million dollars to help you So they're not, but they, you know, they're involved in scenario planning now, so maybe their agenda is, has changed. You know, if Denver Water and the Bureau of Reclamation want to do scenario planning, then, you know, this was epic to us.
Okay.
You know, this didn't happen after the water tank event. It didn't happen after the dump truck event. But talking to 80 to 100 individuals face to face with just me and Owen, bringing sleeping bags and camping out in the seven states of the basin. I mean, sometimes we would get a motel room. But, you know, Owen and I were having a great time. We learned a lot, and we found out that, you know, there's a lot of people out there who actually feel the same way we do, and they want to help. And so we went, well, let's just light a fire here and see where it goes. And sure enough, people started lining up. The people who you wouldn't think would line up are now lined up.
Okay.
So, you know, will it work? I have no idea. But I would say the dialogue has changed a little bit.
Well, let's wrap this back around to something you mentioned. We were talking before we started this interview about another reclamation project. Well, the reclamation has taken this project over from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Oh, the Lake Powell pipeline?
And so clearly, you know, people are, ever larger groups of people are coming together to look at both sides of that cross section of the bell, where it's not just a phenomenal flood event, some sort of catastrophic failure, but it's not enough water in the system to meet demand. And here comes a new straw into the glass, which is about a third full, not quite half full anymore. And that straw is going to yet take more water out of the system.
Yeah, I think you need to realize that the Lake Powell pipeline is what gets the most attention, but it's not the only project.
Right.
There's the Windy Gap firming project. There's the Gross Reservoir expansion. These are
Right.
in the state of Colorado. You have the Erin Million proposal to bring Green River water to the Front Range of Colorado. Wyoming wants to increase diversions from the Green River, you know. And then on the Gila River, there's a water project to extract more water from the Gila water. So yeah, the project, it didn't, it's not stopping these projects.
Right.
And by the way, we're lawsuits. We file lawsuits on all this stuff.
Okay.
Somebody's got to do
Right.
it. Because it's outrageous. You know, you just can't, you know, you don't solve a water shortage process. You don't solve a water shortage problem by building more reservoirs. Just ridiculous. I mean, diversion projects.
Well, this kind of it begs an interesting question, which is, as you know, we're talking about sedimentation, and yeah, you can build more dams, but the ones you've got are filling with sediment, and that means that the new dams will fill with sediment as well. As you say, then you lose flood control. So those two extremes of the bell eventually catch you. But in the meantime, you know, even though Bureau of Reclamation is aware of what's happening, they're continuing with, as you say, continuing with these projects.
This all means there's still a lot of work to done, and that, you know, the states are kind of like not on board.
Meaning the states are looking out for themselves? Okay.
Chamber of Commerce, real estate. You know, it used to be for farmers. It
Right.
used to best be securing borders with populations, and now it's about making sure the never-ending growth cycle does not stop. Growth for the sake of growth. This is a serious ethic. It's a serious problem. Because the earth is finite. Natural resources are finite. You eventually run out of them, and the pollution from the extraction of these natural resources will eventually affect human health and happiness. And then we're already there. But, you know, that money's more important than happiness. Or they assume that money is how you get happiness.
Interesting. Well, on that cheery thought.
Well, that's the fundamental problem, and you know, our economy is why we suffer. And so we need a different economy. I'm not saying we don't need an economy, we just don't need the one we have.
Right. I mean, the other way of looking at this is to flip this around and say, all right, we see that you know, we've put in these massive water projects which have allowed massive growth. And now to sustain or continue that growth, we need to completely rethink our use of water and resources. I mean, just completely rethink it. Otherwise, the pain, the foreseeable pain looks pretty terrifying.
Well, yeah, you know, what it initiated was an episode of plunder.
Right.
Okay, well, the raid is over with, you know. Now what do we do? I mean, it's like talking to pirates.
Well, it's plunder. It's interesting thinking of plunder, thinking of First Nations fighting with each other, and then the Europeans arrive to fight with each other and the First Nations in a journey of plunder, and one group gets the other hand in a war, whether it's the Brits fighting the Brits to form a country called America, or the Spanish fighting the Spanish to form a country called Mexico, and the French are in there as well, all fighting the people that got there first, the First Nations, and this is a journey of plunder. So we have a long history of that. And looking forward, okay, how do we acknowledge that and make sure we don't live outside our means, as the saying goes, whether it's water or natural resources?
Yeah, well, natural resources is why we go to war. And, you know, for Germany, it was that doesn't have oil. You know, of course, they're going to launch a campaign to acquire territories that do have oil. And so that legacy continues.
That's
And
right.
now it's the lack of water is creating wars, especially in the Middle East.
Right. So this, you know, again, the Western states, the seven Western states that make up the Colorado River Basin, must be looking at these projects, Grosse Dam, the Lake Powell pipeline to Kanab and St. George. It must be looking at this going, wait a minute, have we not learned this lesson yet? Because we don't have the supply and the demand that requires these additional infrastructures are dependent on a resource that may not be there.
Right. So the Central Arizona project is designed for 1.6 million acre feet, but that's not going to happen.
Right.
And it's going to, you know, that aqueduct is going to be half full. And eventually it will go empty.
Well, this is the interesting thing about the Central Arizona project, which is sort of junior in the whole rights concept. Here comes new construction to take water out of the upper basin. Central Arizona project's in the lower basin, but the upper basin is taxed with providing a certain amount of water every year to lower basin that the CAP relies on. And it seems as though a straw like this in the upper basin will set the upper basin states that must have them worried, would they be able to continue to meet the downstream obligations?
Yes. And I think they are concerned about that. And the attitude of Utah is, we don't care. We want our water. St. George is growing.
I get that for Utah, but the Bureau of Reclamation is in control of this project and plan. Wouldn't they be looking at the water supplies going, can we build this thing, but will we have water to go in it?
Well, we certainly hope that the document will say that.
Hmm.
They might, who knows, they might choose the conservation alternative proposed by Western Resource Advocates, which means don't build the project, just start doing water conservation programs.
Right.
And maybe that will become the preferred alternative. But that won't make the state of Utah happy. So, it's going into a lawsuit situation, that is for sure.
Okay.
So it's not going to be a slam dunk EIS. It'll definitely be litigated and could, you know, by the time it's over with, who knows, Lake Powell and Lake Mead might be empty and people will finally go, okay, yeah, this is like too much. We're not going to do this.
Right. Right. We get it. We see it. Yeah.
But don't forget, I mean, I'll be completely honest, the hydrological cycle can go the other way.
That's right. That's right. And they could say, gee, we need more dams because we're swimming in water. We don't want these dams to fail, so let's build more.
Only problem is there's no place to put them.
Oh, they'll think it's...
Unless the National Park Service decides to let it happen.
Right, right.
So yeah, it's going to be a challenge for the National Park Service.
Right, as it always has been. Since the days of Hetch Hetchy.
Good point. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
And that was 110 years ago. John Muir's last fight.
Mm-hmm. And the first journey of the Park Service looking one way and water managers looking another.
Yep.
And that continues.
The so-called liberal San Francisco people.
Those lower basin state people, they're all that, just it's their problem.
Water projects aren't, you know, they're very partisan, you know. Used to be Republicans didn't like spending money for this kind of stuff. And Democrats supported water projects more than Republicans did, but now it doesn't seem to matter. Everybody wants a water project.
It's interesting to see the, look at the two parties. It seems like there's always been a contingent of either party coming down one side or the other of the issue. I was thinking of Echo Park, where Republicans didn't want it, and Republicans did want it, and Democrats didn't want it, and Democrats did want it, and the dids and the didn'ts about equaled out.
Yeah, well, let's look at that. Let's see. Let's think about this for a minute. So Roosevelt's a Republican, right? But he's also has a conservation ethic, a multiple-use conservation ethic. Hoover's a Republican. Hoover Dam was authorized in his term, or while he was campaigning, but he's the one who initiated all the contracts. But Roosevelt is a four-term Democratic president, and he just left and right those dams.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Grand Coulee. And then we have Eisenhower, who authorizes Colorado River Storage Project Act. But, of course, all that came from the Natural Resources Committee, who is chaired by Wayne Aspinall from Grand Junction, a Democrat.
Right.
And then...
And it was interesting, you know, in that fight, people were like, we want to keep the National Park sacrosanct. We don't want Echo Park Dam, but we're okay with Glen Canyon Dam and all these other dams, Navajo and Flaming Gorge, and we're fine with that.
Yeah.
And that was coming out of both Republicans and the Democrats and the conservation community as a whole.
Yeah.
So I think we've come a long way to realize maybe this whole concept of big dams on this river is not such a good idea, whether it's the Mississippi or the Colorado or the Missouri. You know, this concept of, okay, well, we're just going to build lots of dams and locks and we're going to channelize this flow. Maybe there's another way.
Yeah. Well, the Colorado is unique because of the deep canyon structures in the basin. You know, it's perfect for building dams. It's, you know, there's what? 25 rivers in the United States, including Alaska, that are bigger than the Colorado River, but the Colorado River has the two largest reservoirs in the United States.
Right.
I mean, right there, you know, how can a little river support the two largest reservoirs under a system of total consumption? You know, there's no surplus anymore, you know.
Right.
Of course the reservoirs are going to go down. And it's also the muddiest river of the 25.
And the most saline.
And, yeah, and it has a huge paleo flood record to demonstrate that the spillways weren't built correctly.
Right.
So, yeah, it's, you know, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Right. Well, that's the, what makes the bell ring, the far ends of the bell-shaped curve there. So, low probability, high severity.
High consequence.
Yeah, yes.
I think that's what they call it.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Black swans.
Hmm. Right.
Eventually, swans are known to be white, but eventually when a black one shows up, why is that?
Well, it's the variability of natural systems. And there they are. John, I want to say this has been most enlightening and a most enjoyable interview. But
thank you.
I think our chariot's going to turn into a pumpkin here. And is there anything else you'd like to bring in before we wrap this up?
No, it's gone long enough.
Well, thank you very much. This concludes part 6, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with John Weisite. Today is Friday, December 6th, 2019. My name is Tom Martin. And John, thank you so very much for this.